And now, an ad from Dad.
All right. Save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive.
Can I take these off?
All right.
What is this? This looks good.
Wow. That's well made.
Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Creating a Family. Talk about adoption and infertility. Today's show will be an interview with Dr. Karen Purvis, the author of The Connected Child. We are a weekly radio show podcast, and to make sure that you automatically hear about each episode, you can subscribe to our show at either iTunes or on the radio page of our website, creatingafamily.org/radioshow. I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Adoption and Infertility Education Organization providing support and unbiased information before, during, and after adoption or fertility treatment to help create strong families. As I mentioned before, you can find us online at creatingafamily.org. The Creating a Family radio show is proud to say that we are underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Fighting cancer doesn't have to mean a loss of your fertility. If you or a loved one are facing cancer, you may be eligible for no-cost medications through Ferring's Heartbeat program. To learn more, you can go to their website, heartbeatprogram.com. I have two favors to ask. If you are a fan of Creating a Family and you want to help us, do us a favor and please rate this podcast on iTunes. You can go to the creatingafamily.org radio show page and click on the iTunes buttons, and that will allow you to give us a star rating and we would love to have a comment as well. Or if you already have iTunes on your computer because you're a regular user of iTunes, just go to iTunes, type in the search box Creating a Family, and you will also get to the rating page. Our second favor is we primarily keep in touch with our audience through our twice weekly e-newsletter, and we would very much like to have you as a member of that community. It's a great way for us to reach out and communicate with you directly about specific areas that you are of interest to. All of our resources are offered without charge, and so we disseminate the information about them through the newsletter. Please go to our website and find the newsletter box and sign up. We'd very much appreciate it. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support from all of our gold sponsors who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education. Some of those sponsors would include Nightlight Christian Adoption. They've been providing adoption services for more than 50 years with offices in California, Colorado, South Carolina, and Kentucky. They provide international, domestic, foster, and embryo donation and adoption services. We also have Bethany Christian Services. They provide post-adoption support to all members of the Adoption Constellation through branch offices and through their National Post-Adoption Contact Center. The Post-Adoption Contact Post-Adoption Contact Center is staffed by licensed adoption competent professionals and is available from 8 to 8 Eastern Time. You can connect with them BCS postadopt@bethany.org. We have independent adoption centers. Their mission is to provide open adoption placement and counseling to birth and adoptive families. They work with families throughout the United States, and they're fully licensed in California, New York, Florida, Texas, and more. And then there's Hopscotch Adoptions. They're a national adoption agency with offices in North Carolina and New York, and they place children from Bulgaria, Georgia, Ghana, Armenia, Morocco, Serbia, and Ukraine. We have the law offices of James Fletcher Thompson, a South Carolina firm committed to adoption and assisted reproductive law. And last but certainly not least, we have Children's Connection. They are an adoption agency with offices throughout Texas, providing domestic infant adoption, embryo donation adoption, home studies, and post-adoption support to families throughout the United States. When you support those who support us, you are doing us a great service, and we very much appreciate it. And we thank you. As I said, today is going to be an interview with the great Karen Purvis. Karen has, this is an interview that we did in 2008, and we are re-airing it now because I've listened to it recently, and I just want to get the word out about her. Her compassion for children and for parents just shines in this interview. It is truly a gem. Dr. Purvis is the co-author of the book, The Connected Child. She is also the director of the Institute of Child Development at Texas Christian University. She is an expert in attachment. She is an expert in healing children who have been abused and neglected, or as she calls them, children from hard places. I am so happy to present this interview with Dr. Purvis, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. Welcome, Dr. Purvis.
Thank you, Dawn. It's great to be with you.
I absolutely loved this book. I really did. It was it made me feel good reading the book. It did. You were concrete. You were practical. You took a very holistic approach. And because yours and other research shows that it's not just one problem usually. It's usually many factors that are all tied together, but they could take the same approach to dealing with them. And I just really appreciate your having written this book.
Thanks, Don. It's sweet to hear.
Tell me, how did you come to your interest in helping adoptive families?
Do you know, many years ago when my children were at home, we fostered. So we've always been called, I've been called, and then my kids, a passion for our family is the child who comes from what we call hard places. And when my last boy left for college, I came back to get a PhD and immediately was blessed to fall into some research with adoptive families and was smitten by our research findings and the knowledge that if we could teach families to do these things, that we could make a difference for a lot of kiddos and a lot of mamas and daddies.
Yeah, well, and for those of us on the other, the receiving end, thank you. We have a caller at area code 561. Do you have a question for Dr. Purvis? I think we probably have somebody trying to listen through their phone. You don't need to do that. Feel free to just stream through your computer. In your book, you talk about a number of steps that parents can approach when they have a child that is struggling. And the first one is disarm your child's fear response. And I liked that. How can we tell if our children's if their misbehavior is actually being propelled by fear rather than just orneriness?
That's a great question, and one a lot of parents ask, Dawn. For us, we're going to take the assumption that a lot of kids from hard places have a level of chronic fear that is even submerged from their own awareness. So a little noise might set them off. The wrong food might set them off. Asking them to turn off the television and go to bed might set them off, where they've got this neurochemical pattern of fear that makes them hair trigger. So some of the things that we're looking for, a child who looks ADHD is very often hypervigilant, okay? So they're always on alert. A child who has chronically dilated pupils, that tells me that the stress chemicals are coursing through their body all the time. A child who has shallow breathing, that tells me that they've got a stress alert. That's that little rabbit in the road trying to be real still so you don't see them. A child who has, like you can see sometimes, tightening of the jaw muscle. The hands might close up. And what we're going to know is there are going to be physiological markers, biological markers that will tell us the child is in a stress response.
And one of the things you talk about is keeping compassion in your parenting techniques, kind of as your reference point. It seems like this would be easier when the parent is getting proper support. One of the things I spend in the last chapter of my book a fair amount of time doing is talking about self-care, being taking care of yourself.
Yeah,
because
huge.
Adoptive parents, particularly if they have a child who is, let's euphemistically say, high maintenance, they need to take care of themselves, and then they can take care of their child. And is your research also, have you done any research on that as well?
We actually have, Dawn. And one of the things about helping build compassion for us is a neurotransmitter test. But I've got those not only on 1,000 adopted children, but I've also got them on many parents. So let me back up and tell you what this is. A neurotransmitter is a chemical in the body that helps you think and feel and move and digest your food and sleep well and learn and memorize and so forth. So it's just a little chemical messenger. So neurotransmitter word sometimes, you know, sounds like it's a big scientific jargon, but it just means the chemicals in your body. Mm-hmm. So what we know, one of the things that has helped us build compassion in parents who are looking at a child with horrific behaviors, is when we get back, when we use a urine assay, you can get a neurotransmitter level from any of the body fluids, but we use neurotransmitters levels from urine. And when we get those back and parents see that they have children who have the adrenals of a 90-year-old because they are mm-hmm. under chronic fear, it helps the parents understand, so this misbehavior is not about me. It's really not even intended against me, but this child's still reacting against something that happened to them before I helped them have a safe home.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, by the same token, Dawn, we've got neurotransmitter data on adoptive parents, and I can tell you that moms and dads are fried neurochemically too. Many of our mamas, many of our daddies also have the adrenals of a 90-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are chronically stressed by trying to love a child that they can't seem to reach, or trying to deal with behaviors that keep coming at them that they can't seem to solve.
Exactly. And we're going to move into some concrete advice. However, I do want to start more with, it seems to me that you're basically suggesting a philosophical shift first. And then this book is full of very practical techniques. But first, it's the philosophy. And I loved your analogy of you and your child tackling the world together as a team, out there finding solutions, overcoming problems. And it's that philosophy that I think permeates the book and gives it its real strength, because the techniques without the attitude, but they probably will work, but I don't know that they would be as effective.
I think you're right, Dawn. I don't think that those techniques have the kind of life-giving power to help bring healing if there's not an attitude behind them. But sometimes we can just start with a technique moving towards that goal, and then ultimately, before we know it, our heart catches up with us.
Exactly. Yes. You know? We have a call from area code 267. Do you have a question for Dr. Purvis?
I do. I actually had a couple questions.
Okay, jump in.
They're a little bit, I know you guys were kind of talking a little bit further on, but we have not adopted yet. We're in the process.
Okay.
And I had two questions. One of them, as far as attachment signs in the orphanage, you know, you hear if the kids get really upset and they, you know, want to stay with their caregiver, that's actually a good thing. Is there any point where, when they're not reacting to you in any way, that can also be a sign that they're, you know, potentially going to have a problem attaching if they show no attachment to you at all?
How old a child are you talking about?
Under two.
Okay.
And this is obviously from a country that is allowing you to...
From Russia.
From Russia.
Yes.
So you are
mm-hmm.
on your first trip, so to speak, meeting the child.
Right.
And you're trying to make decisions based on that meeting.
Right. And, you know, I you hear all the time, it's great if they scream when you come in the room. It's great if they're attached to the caregivers. But at what point do you kind of see, you know, is that ever, you know, a sign of that they're not going to be able to bond with you? Or?
And in general, I hear you asking kind of what are some signs that you could
yeah.
look for at that stage. Dr. Purvis, do you have any suggestions?
Yes, I really do. That's a good question. One of the things that we know from attachment research from dozens of labs across the country and across the world is if you're moving a child at a good age, a lot of times babies will be moved when they have just started to form an attachment, and if that first just baby step towards attachment gets ruptured, usually about 7 months. That's not an optimal time to move a child from the foster system or from an orphanage. So two will have bypassed that marker. But here's what I would say. If the child is securely attached, what we know from others' research and our own, to a caregiver, they have learned to keep their heart open and they've learned to trust.
Okay.
And the fact that they have trusted someone deeply enough to connect to them would be a good sign that they know the path to trust. So they'll be able to grieve that loss, but you have to let them, and then their heart can come to you.
But what are the signs she can look for in the first meeting?
Yes. Well, let me differentiate one. No, that's great, Dawn. Let me differentiate one thing so I don't forget it. May I?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. So a child who screams also when they first meet you, it may be a fear response because you're going to look different. You're going to smell different. You're going to sound different. And it's possible that you're a stress stimulus to that child. So you're going to have to differentiate those things.
I was
right.
My daughter the very first time. She was frightened of, I look different, I smell different, I smell different. And she cried. And it, of course it broke my heart, but it is indeed, she was just frightened of me.
Absolutely.
Now, what if they like you and they go to you? Does that necessarily mean that they can't attach?
No, it doesn't. But what you need to expect is that bringing a child from an impoverished environment like that, you're going to expect to work on attachment. So maybe in a minute we could talk about some specific things. I think Dawn was even already alluding to some specific things. Some of the stuff you're going to look for when you go to meet your child. You expect a child who's alerted or overstimulated by who you are to look away. Their eyes may avert. They may turn their whole body away from you if they're a little more alerted. They may even begin to spit up. So spitting up gastric distress is a sign, that a child is feeling anxiety, tension.
And that's not necessarily bad.
No, it's just a normal stress response.
And different kids have different temperaments.
Yes. Exactly. And different children will have had different experiences in the 2 years that they've, like, for example, that your child is coming home from. So what you're going to do is just expect that your child will have some stress response, and that's okay. So that'll be kind of the things we talked about. Just expect that your child will have some attachment distress, even if they're securely attached to somebody. A caregiver in an orphanage where shifts change every certain number of hours and shift change by days and weeks can't have the kind of attachment that she would have had or he would have had if they had come straight home to you, right?
Right.
So you're gonna plan to move with respect into the child's space.
Okay.
So make glancing eye contact. Don't let them thrust her into your arms. Did you say little girl? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Did you say little? Yes. Okay. So don't let them thrust her into your arms. Let her use the caregiver there as a base from which to explore.
Okay.
Offer her some kind of toy. Make glancing eye contact at her and then look at the caregiver, or make glancing eye contact at her and then look away so that you don't come so intense into her space that she feels threatened.
Right.
Does that make sense?
And
then as you have those visits, if you're allowed more than one visit, some places will allow you to visit every day and spend 2 or 3 hours. Let her use the caregiver that she feels some connection to explore, crawl to you, come to a toy. Here's something I do with kids. I am a less preferred object. An attractive toy, but not one that's too loud, too noisy, too overstimulating. But attractive toy is a more preferred object.
Okay.
So I pair myself with a more preferred object, and by reference, I become more safe to the child.
Right.
So I might take a toy, and I might roll it to the child. Maybe I've got a little ball that lights real gently, and I might roll that to her and see if she wants to play a game with me.
Okay.
And I use some things, objects, as bridges.
Okay.
But just expect her to be overstimulated. Just expect her to have some
right.
type of stress response, and just expect her to have an attachment distress. Those are all normative, wouldn't you say, Dawn?
Definitely. But I think her question, but it's so
hard. Is there anything that's
say,
like a red flag that you're like, this child is really going to have major, you know, may never attach, or I know you can't tell.
A big red flag the day that I'm looking at my daughter for the first time. Well, let me tell you my world. In my world, we've worked with kids that were newborns, drug exposed, and I've worked with a 16-year-old who tried to cut her mother's throat with a butcher knife. And I have found no child who wasn't waiting for someone to understand them and connect to them so that they could come to us. Okay?
Attachment isn't all or none either.
Right.
There are things you
right.
can do that can so improve. But I hear what you're saying. You're coming from the perspective of, I want to avoid, you know, the train wreck if possible.
Right. And is there, what if we'll make absolutely no eye contact with you, for example? Is that
I start with kids like that all the time. So not making eye contact at all can be visual overstimulation. It can be a sensory problem. It can be hyper alert, which is being over taxed by this new person, and it can be an attachment issue, and it can be a neurological issue. So which one is it, or is it all?
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, if you're committed to this adoption, then go armed with, what do I do about that? And so you'll find in our book, and then it's there are other really good resources where you can touch the chin of the child really gently and say, let me see eyes, and just get a little tiny bit of eye contact. So if she won't make eye contact at all with you, it could be any of those things that we talked about. If she shrieks violently when she sees you, there are any of those things that it could be.
Okay.
So the question for me is, and Don, help me here, because I'm not sure, maybe I want to go forward to, maybe I'm not being alert enough here with the caller. I guess the thing that I want to say is, I would expect some of those kinds of things. I was interviewed for a Newsweek story, I think, that came out like in December with some stuff about our work. And a mother had a little 2-year-old Russian child who every time she tried to kiss her, rubbed the kiss off. Well, see, that can be neurological. That was too much alert. That can be stress. That was too much alert. That can be sensory processing. That was too soft and feathery. I can't manage it. Or that could be attachment. Or that could be all of it. But
okay.
The question is, how do I help that child overcome the aversion to touch? How do I help that child overcome the aversion to eye contact and understanding what's going on? For me, a child that you pick up, when she finally comes to you, maybe she stiffens away from you. That
mm-hmm.
can be sensory stuff. That can be neurological stuff. That can be fear stuff. That can be attachment stuff. That can be all of it. So what do I do in a holistic manner that meets all of those needs? Does that make sense?
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I don't know if there is the one magic sign, and I appreciate so much you're wanting it, but I don't know that there is the one thing that if
right.
this child does this, then this means. I think that what I hear Dr. Purvis saying is that it can mean any number of things, and each child is so unique, just as each adult is. Our temperaments play as well. So an affectionate child doesn't necessarily mean a problem, any more than a child that is non-affectionate and avoiding eye contact.
Right.
If there's any way that you can spend more than just one time with the child, I think that is truly helpful. It also helps sometimes to have spent time with other children before you go, so that you kind of, you may have a lot of experience with kids, but if you don't, sometimes it's helpful to kind of know what is normal, you know, that
mm-hmm.
So that you don't then overinterpret this child's
right.
talking all over the room. Well, yeah, most 2-year-olds do.
Right.
Or, you know, things like that I think would be helpful. Now, you said you had another question, or have we addressed that as well?
The other question was actually when they come home and, you know, if you have a kid that's, you know, in that age of the normal for cancer ways, how do you know I think sometimes it's very hard to figure out, you know, where that line of permissiveness is, because you want to give them.
You're blanking out.
Give them actually. More space than my biological child, but you don't want them you know, misbehaving or thinking that, you know, I have always felt that children feel much more secure when they know where the line is and the line does change. And, you know, sometimes I feel like, you know, some of the books that I've read on attachment I felt were more like kind of let the kid do whatever they want. And
let me tell you, get this book, The Connected Child. I know exactly what you're saying. And I thought that the Dr. Purvis and Dr. Cross and Wendy Sunshine, those are the authors of the book, did a really good job of addressing that line between structure and nurturance, that connection
okay.
versus it's a. I think you raised such an interesting point that there is a line there, and children do need, but you can do need structure. But it can be done, and that was what we were talking about before, the philosophical. It's almost like once your philosophy, once you understand the philosophy, that the techniques themselves flow from that, and I think that that, to me, is where this book really shone, this is where it was at its best, was that nebulous line between the two.
Yeah.
So
that's great because,
yeah.
you know, you worry about, I worry about that because I know if I was completely permissive with my biological son, he would have been horrible.
And then in no way do they say that. In no way is she encouraging in this book.
Right.
They encourage that.
Can I ask, how old is your biological child?
He's 10.
10. Okay, so mm-hmm. so you'll have a good bit of, you know, he has a good bit of understanding on board about what's happening. Can
oh, yeah.
I make a couple of quick recommendations?
Oh, absolutely.
About your balance? And thanks, Dawn, for talking about that. That really is the heart of our work, is helping parents find that balance between structure and nurture. One recommendation that you'll find us talk about, remember when your child comes home, that she will have the independence needs of a 2-year-old, but she'll also have the nurture needs of a newborn.
Mm-hmm.
So be compassionate as you give balanced portions of structure and nurture. If she's behaving as a healthy 2-year-old, and you've already been through that with your son, so you know that a healthy 2-year-old should be pushing away and demanding independence and so forth. But if she has those healthy needs and you have to give her more structure, up the ante on your nurture too. Okay.
Okay.
Don't be in
a hurry.
So
it's always balanced.
Yes. And for a child who requires, for a 16-year-old who tried to cut her mother's throat, she obviously needs structure, right? But we
yeah.
also have to work to find as much time for nurture
love. Yeah.
and as many opportunities, because it's that deep connection that will ultimately help a 2-year-old know that you can be the boss because you're safe.
So do you recommend regressing them a little bit, like with the bottle or the rock?
Do you know that she will guide you if you will
okay.
let her? She will show you what she needs. But here's one thing that is so simple, but it's absolutely critical. Please don't rush out of the home with her. You know, everybody wants to have a party
right.
and everybody wants to meet her and everybody. But bring her home. In most cultures after a birth, up until this last generation or so, after a birth, a woman's considered unclean and she doesn't leave the house for 40 days, 80 days, depending on what culture you're in and
mm-hmm.
the sex of the child. Bring her home and let her figure out what a family is. Remember, a kitchen will be a new thing to her. You know, a brother will
right.
be a new thing. English will be a new thing. All of the foods are foreign. Let her room be simple. Let her life demands be simple. Let her figure out what mommy and daddy and brother mean.
Actually,
okay.
this goes nicely into a question we got via email from Cindy. When making the transition from staying at home with my son, who is 16 months old, to daycare, what steps can I take to continue to foster the attachment that we have worked so hard to build? We adopted him 3 months ago. We want him to have a healthy relationship with his new caregivers, but we want to make sure that he is clear that we are mommy and daddy, and we fear that the growth we have made will be undone quickly. Can you
That's
address that from Cindy? Yeah.
Yeah, important question. Well, one thing, in the same way that we would ask this first caller if the orphanage will allow you to make visits and let the child use the caregiver there to explore the relationship from, in the same way for this caller, for Cindy, one of the things that would come out of our research in our intervention work across the world, really, with children, is to also, as this little one goes into Mother's Day Out or the daycare, for her to be the transition person, moving him in slowly. So I always assume talking to a little one that they are spirit, even if their mind doesn't get all of it, that they understand the tone of my voice and the meaning of my words. So mommy's going to go in and stay for 15 minutes, or mommy's going to go in and stay with you today, but tomorrow mommy's going to need to leave. Or I'm going to go in for an hour today, and tomorrow I'll stay a little bit shorter. So that that child doesn't also, we have to remember for a child who's had a impoverished early start, maybe the first year of life before they came home to you, that they've got a sense of stress that's higher than other children. So we want to make sure transitions are safe and the child can use us, in this case, to explore going into a communal setting with other children. One of the things in the morning when the child cries when you leave him, you want to reinforce his desire to be with you, but then he also has to reinforce staying in the room. So I would give even a small child, I would give choices. Do you want mommy to stay for 10 minutes? And then go in and set for 10 minutes. We don't mind a child. We ultimately want him to go in without crying, and we want him to leave there at the end of the day, coming back to the mother. So, Cindy, when he comes back to you, we don't want him to cry when he leaves the caregiver there. That would be a warning signal for you. That,
do you
that,
have a? I assume that Cindy doesn't have a choice, but do you have? And many people do not. So this is not intended to be a guilt-inducing question.
No.
But how long would you, if people have the choice, how long do you recommend that a mom or a dad stay home with the child before you consider going back to work or daycare?
If a family has a choice, I would stay home as long as I could and put a child maybe just in a one-day-a-week Mother's Day out.
Mm-hmm.
Or two,
yes,
two
to give
mornings.
The mom a break. Yeah.
That's right, to give the mom a break. Or if a mom can work, I know some moms who are able to work half days. So, I mean, the optimal would be to take the child for shorter periods, especially, you know, a child who's come home recently. Because that child is still figuring out what a family is still figuring out. And the meaning of going into a more communal setting again may be different. It may load differently to that child. But
is
here's
possible
another thing.
Perhaps to start going back part-time so the child is only in half days for a
yes.
period of time, if that's something that Cindy has the option to do, which she may not.
Exactly, exactly. If that's not an option, Dawn, one of the things that we find parents doing very successfully is if a mom, like, is a school teacher and she's going to be at school. Oh, dear, so sorry about that. If a mom's a school teacher and she's going to be at school, the thing that what we would like to see that mom do is try to do the homework during your breaks. Try to do your grading during your breaks so that if there's the need or that when you pick the child up, immediately your full attention is back to the child.
Mm-hmm.
So try to think about what is some clever way that I can have a meal prepared tonight. What is a one-pot dish? How can my husband and I trade off evening responsibilities? So the goal would be not that you're near the child, not that you're around the child, not that the child is in the car or in the house with you, but that your eyes are meeting the child's eyes. And you're having specific play time, letting that child lead you into play. So do you want to play with your blocks with mommy? Do you want to play and give a couple of choices? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does very much. Here's a question from La Quinta. My teen son has recently been diagnosed with an auditory processing disorder. Could you please explain what an auditory processing disorder is and what are some specific ways that we can help him at home and at school? Any advice would really be appreciated.
Wonderful question. What you'll find is that a lot of kids have auditory processing issues. In our studies, the children that have, like, formal hearing problems, maybe there's 19-20% or so, but children who have processing difficulties with words are greatly increased. Now, getting a formal diagnosis, so there's a spectrum there. So auditory processing simply means this child won't process a lot of words. So sermons, lectures, paragraphs.
And you don't mean
are
to the church. I think you mean parental.
No,
yes.
That's right. That's right. So a lecture about what the child did wrong, why you didn't get that, that's going to be, here's what we use, few words, brief scripts. With our children in the high-risk kids that we serve in a camp environment, we say things like, listen and obey. Obey first time. try that again with respect. Gentle and kind. Good, being gentle and kind. So we're going to try to use short scripts that are loaded with meaning. If I use, we say in Texas, there's an expression, spitting in the wind. Mm-hmm. We say if you use more than 12 words with a child who's come from a hard place, you're spitting in the wind. More than 12 words, their eyes glaze over, and you've lost them.
You know, I have a child with an auditory processing disorder, and I will tell you that it has been a struggle for me as a parent because I'm a very verbal person.
Mm.
And it's my mode, it's my comfort mode. When I'm trying to connect with somebody, I do it verbally. And one of the things that I have done, and I won't say that I have always been successful because I have not, and I am truly a work in progress, but I've given my child the words to say to me, okay, I need you to stop talking now, but in a polite way. I need quiet. I need giving him permission to say, okay, it's not coming in anymore, because he needs mm-hmm. to be able to tell mm-hmm. me to stop. And I, but you know, if a kid says shut up to me, that really doesn't go over very well.
Right. And you know, that's a powerful tool to give a child. Mom, that's I can't do any more words.
Mm-hmm.
And,
exactly.
And I would
it's
like
how
you.
We say it is that I can't handle words right now. Or I need to be alone right now. Or I need to process. I just it doesn't matter. It just makes me. And then I realize, okay, I've gone over.
Yes.
I try to explain to him that we're different. That I feel the need. It's not that I'm trying to overload him, but that's my fallback. And so I don't know.
Well, and like so, like a couple of things that parents can keep in mind. And Dawn, you added this, I'm sure, because of your richness of your experience. But keep in mind, don't give like a stack of auditory instructions. Go to your room, brush your teeth, get your homework, come back down to the kitchen table, and then we're going to be leaving for school in 15 minutes. You know, that was five instructions. So for a child who processes with auditory processing, they got the first one or the last one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to say, sweetie, go to your room and make your bed and then come back to breakfast. That's going to be a nice process. When I talk to a child with auditory processing, I'm going to want to connect with other senses too to maximize. So I'm going to maybe hold one of their hands or put a hand on an older child's shoulder, touch their chin to make sure I've got eye contact. Sweetie, would you go do your homework now? I'm going to give instructions with more than just the auditory sense. I want eye contact, so they're going to have a visual sense. They're going to have visual activation in the brain, and I'm going to maybe touch their shoulder, their arm, or hold one of their hands or both of their hands while I look into their eyes. The more, if I have only auditory processing going on, the child's auditory sense is a very tiny path through the jungle. Mm-hmm. But if I open up touch and sight and other tactile and other things, I'm going to open more up a freeway. So they're not leaning only on a sense that's weak. One other instruction, Dawn, that we find really helpful with families is make your interactions more action-based. So rather than giving a child grabs a pencil out of your hand and you start with a lecture. Why do you grab that? I don't appreciate you taking it like that. So you start in with more than 12 words, right? So for us, the child with an auditory processing issue grabs a pencil that I'm using, and I say, "Whoa, stop! What do you need?" Well, I wanted the pencil. Good. Try it with words. See, that was, and then the child does a behavioral action to get their needs met, and they learn by using that behavioral action rather than by a lecture or a sermon from me.
Here is a question from Stella. My 2.5-year-old daughter was adopted at 14 months from China. We know almost nothing about her early life other than she was abandoned at birth and spent the first 14 months at the same orphanage. On our pickup trip, she totally rejected me, showing a strong preference for my husband. Our relationship has improved significantly, but she does not seem to be as attached as I would think she should be. Dawn, I've heard you talk about this on some of your other shows. What would you or Dr. Purvis recommend that I do to increase our bond? Have you seen this as well, where children will show a preference to either to one or the other parent?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, Dawn, for us, it's interesting that but it's the inverse. For it, depending on what the child's experience was in the orphanage, it may be that a woman mistreated her, and so a man looks like a safe option. It may be that a man was kind to her, and so she has a preference to go to a man.
Or the man is different enough that he is not challenging her primary attachment, which may have been to a woman.
That's exactly true.
Nice.
Some of the things that we would ask parents to do, again, remember, we don't want objects. We don't want our children in love with objects. We want their hearts connected to us. But we use objects as our tools. And so it would very likely be a good goal for this mom to have a set of special things that she and the child do together, maybe specially intriguing toys that are her special bridges to this child. And it is not, here's a toy, go play. I gave you a good toy, but here is a toy, come play with. And so we use that as a bridge, and it may be a special food. Maybe mommy takes her to get a special ice cream, or it may be a special food that they share together in the home, a special kind of a cracker that they feed each other, a special kind of animal mm-hmm. cookie that becomes an animal cookie game. So I would build rituals that are mommy-child rituals that are their special rituals, and daddy will be respectful. I'm sure all daddies want to help their families. Bond to let this be mommy's special time
mm-hmm.
or mommy's special activity or mommy's special food, and use those kind of bridges to help her overcome whatever thing it is in the past that she's associated with this mom.
Here is a question from Suzanne. My daughter lies. I can't figure out the natural consequence for lying because loss of parental trust is a hard concept to grasp. I really don't know why she lies other than not wanting to be punished. We don't punish excessively at all. For example, she borrowed my iPod and forgot to recharge it. When I asked her where my iPod was, she said she didn't know and then tried to sneak up to her room to get it and replace it on the charger. This is not a big deal, but it is an example of the little lies that go on all the time. There are, of course, big lies as well. It's almost as if she lies before she thinks. Do you have any suggestions for Suzanne? That's a hard one.
It's a very hard one. You know, I would love to know the age of this child and what her early history was. But from our experience with children who lie, typically I'm going to look for two things. One is a history that causes them to have some levels of fear, even when they don't need to be afraid. Matter of fact, there's a lot of research right now, fabulous research in the neurosciences going on, that shows that children have chronic activation of the fear systems even when they're not aware of being afraid. And so I would love to know what about her history would evoke a fear of being uncovered or being vulnerable or being caught. Another thing that I would love to know is if this child has got, and I would suspect in a child that fails to have cause and effect thinking, so like you do that, I distrust you as a cause and effect. And a healthy child should be able to know that, but a lot of times children have what's called neurological insult, where the brain chemistry has changed or the brain development was changed mildly from harm, from being abused, from being underfed, from being mistreated, even from exposure to substance or stress, high stress in utero. And so because of those things, what we would have is a child who failed to make the connections that they should make. I would be looking to explore that if a child doesn't have cause and effect thinking. Because, you know, Dawn, a child that's really deeply connected to you and thinking through things doesn't want to disappoint you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would look why this little one is not having cause and effect thinking. In this case, number one, I would be doing things to help the child understand, like when she knew the child was lying about the iPod. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
take the two hands, hold them gently, look into her eyes, sweetheart. Now, do you want to try that again? And see if I can get the child to trust me to tell the truth. But also to try to do things that are body-based again, because if she doesn't have cause and effect thinking, cognitive conversations are not going to make a difference for her. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
so I'm going to try, sweetheart, let's see, you're not in trouble. I just need to get the iPod and take the child's hand. Will you, let's go get it together. Tell me where it is, sweetheart, and we'll go get it. So my goal would be, to, number one, understand if I've got a child who doesn't do cause and effect, I've got a concrete thinker. She doesn't abstract. So concrete abstractions are not going to work. How do I teach my child concretely? And those would be skills and practices. We actually talk about some scripts and some puppet practices and writing stories and telling mutual stories and that kind of skills that parents can use in our work. So how can I do a body-based learning that's not dependent on so much cognitive process? And how do I build a bridge with this child that she understands that being connected to me, part of that is I'm going to be truthful with her and I need her to be truthful with me. I don't know, is that too abstract an answer to help a parent not be abstract?
No, I think it gets to it. You are listening to Creating a Family, Talk About Adoption and Infertility. I'm talking with Dr. Karen Purvis, co-author of The Connected Child. Here's an email that just came in from Lori. I have both of your books and love them both. There's a lot of overlap in Dawn's last chapter and in your book. Both of you talk about the need for routine. This advice has been a huge benefit for my child. He is much happier and easier to live with now that we have a very predictable schedule. Karen, in your book, you talk about using index cards to arrange the child's day and letting the child carry them around. I can't figure out how this works since she gets them all mixed up. Also, how does your idea of using a wild card fit into this idea? But Dr. Purvis, before we talk about it, Lori's specific question, let's talk about the benefit of routines for children and for families.
That's great. You know, I think for the children that come, especially, and let me go back to this, Dawn. If you have a child that had prenatal harm, maybe they didn't receive good nutrients, maybe there wasn't prenatal care, possibly they were exposed to toxins or substance. If you had a child who had a difficult birth, if you had a child who had early hospitalization where they weren't held or touched, or if you have a child who had abuse, neglect, and or trauma, you've got a loading of risk factors that make these fear systems more active, that make the sensory processing more confusing, that make the brain chemistry different, and that make the trusting and bonding and attaching all, we call it a global systems failure. So if a child has one of those risk factors, they're going to have these global system disruptions that we have to be informed about helping them heal. That said, transitions are one of the huge fall apart times for our kids.
Mm-hmm.
They don't
for
process.
All kids, I would add.
That's
I think
right.
For most kids. Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely for all kids. But transitions, it means I'm comfortable right now, but everything's going to change. And how is it going to change? Is it going to be better? Is it going to be worse? And so it can be a sensory thing. It can be a neurological thing. It can be a fear thing. So providing structure for a child in the day just makes things where they can settle in and their little chemistry can settle into a normative. It brings them down off of alert.
Mm-hmm.
So for all children, in 10 minutes, we're going to get out of the swimming pool. I did this with my boys. Now, in 5 minutes, we're going to get out of the swimming pool. Okay. So my child always knows, after we finish this, we're going to go have a snack.
Mm-hmm.
After the movie's over, we're going straight to bed. That gives my child a precursor to preparation for the transition, and that makes it not – I mean, with myself, I'm in the middle of some intriguing movie, and somebody asks me a question. Somebody comes in the room and asks me a movie. A question. I'm intense on this movie. This is the critical moment.
Yeah.
The Titanic is sinking. What am I going to do if I miss this moment? You know, and that's really the way it is for our children. So we need to give them preparation for transition.
True. And as adults, we often know in advance. We already kind of have the big general picture, and that we don't clue our children in, not realizing that they're coming from a different level, and they don't see the big picture, and so we have to actually clue them in.
Yes.
And one of the ways is I do a picture board, but you talk about the index cards. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, the index cards are more helpful in some environments than others, and I'll tell you one example. We buy the little iZoom camera. It's like a little tiny Polaroid. It gives a one-inch picture. So if we have a child who has trouble with any of those systems that we call global systems failure, we would bring that child in, or we have a child that just seems anxious, and that's all, but we know that we can help settle them in faster. We give them the little camera. We take them to each teacher. that's going to be in the course of their routine for the day. We've got the routine posted on the wall, and they go to each classroom and they take a picture of each teacher themselves. Now, they're empowered to have power over their routine because they're holding the camera. Mm-hmm. And they're making their cards, and we're helping them do that. So they take a picture, and they can put a number one, and then Miss Karen, and they know that they're going to be in my classroom first or in my group first, and they can put a number two, and Miss Angel, and they've got a picture of her, and they know that she's going to do the second section, and then they know there's a number three, that's lunch. So for school or a classroom or a camp, maybe the Sunday school, that might be easier than the structure at home. It may be that a picture board's more serviceable at home. But the wild card for us is, you know, there's always, to the best of our plans, there's always some chance of change, right? And so we have a wild card, and we try to teach the child. Sometimes the wild thing happens and we didn't expect it, and so we might do a wild card and try to make it less aversive, like there's a big smiley face or a picture of some child with a surprised face. But the wild card just means, oh, look, we're on number three card, and we're supposed to go to number four card, but, oh, it just rained, so we can't go on the playground. So now what we're going to do, what can we do now? And so we brainstorm a new choice.
Got it. I think that does make sense. Let's talk about what to do in the highly unlikely event that your little angel misbehaves. You stress that the parental response must combine firmness, kindness, and retraining. And I love your advice about not taking misbehavior personally. To approach it in just a matter-of-fact training manner. Now, that's easier said than done, I would acknowledge, but it is important to realize that their behavior is not necessarily directed at you. I would assume parents have a hard time with that. I certainly know that it's been a struggle for me.
Oh, I do think that's absolutely true for parents, because here you're investing, you know, heart and soul in a child who is pushing you away or who is combative with you. And it's real hard for a parent many, many times just to take a deep breath, step back, disengage from the child's frenzy. And for us, one of the things that we ask parents to do is to help the children learn to breathe and calm themselves. At this point, the parent takes a deep breath. Plants, if you're standing, plant your weight on both feet so you're connected. You're feeling your presence. You're coming back present to yourself, feeling centered and balanced. You're not offset by the child's misbehavior. You take a deep breath. You lower your voice, and you might hold out two fingers. So, for example, let me give you an example.
Yes, please.
A child is on the playground, and she says to me, pick me up and carry me in the building. Now, there's no chance I'm going to do that, right? But I'm going to first recognize this is about her history. This is the way she learned to get things done, by controlling and manipulation and aggression on her own part. So those skills are skills that are not going to work here. So first I'm going to try playful engagement. Well, are you asking me or telling me? And I might be able to even say it playfully, are you asking or telling? And at that point, the child might capitulate and say, well, I was asking. I say, okay, try it again with respect. Now, if that child can say, could you please pick me up and carry me in now? We've both won, because she's learned I want to meet her need, but she has to ask me with respect.
Mm-hmm. But she now, got her need met, and you got your need met. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. And we've got a mutually respectful interaction going on. That's the best of all the worlds, right?
Yes.
But now, in the case of the little girl who taught me this on the playground, I said, are you asking or telling? And she said, I'm telling. This is a little five-year-old whose mother called her Tiny Taliban. So she says, I'm telling you, pick me up and carry me in. And I said, and so I leaned down, not in a threatening way. I put two fingers up towards, we're about 12 inches from her face, not in a threatening gesture, but just simply I moved my hand, I hold the two fingers in front of her, and I touched the one finger, and I said, you have these two choices, and I touched the one finger. You can walk beside me and hold my hand, or you can walk beside me going into the building. Which do you choose? Or the choices could be anything. You can ask me with respect, or you can walk beside me. Mm-hmm. But it's clear that I'm giving her power to negotiate with respect, but she needs to ask appropriately, and ultimately I'm the mommy, so I have to be the boss. Now, I'm going to be a good boss. I'm going to be a sensitive boss, but she has to let me be the boss. Here's the deal, Dawn. If I can't be the boss of a five-year-old, a loving, affectionate, interactive, respectful boss of that five-year-old, how does she trust me to protect her from somebody who's going to harm her, right? So if I don't know what to do with her, what am I going to do with somebody who hurt her in the past if they come again? So I say to this little girl, you've got two choices. You can walk beside me and hold my hand, or you can walk beside me as we go into the building. Which do you choose? Now, again, I've given her power. I've given her the ability to make a compromise with me, but I've also set a clear boundary for her. And this little one will say, and she capitulate, might capitulate and say, can I walk beside you and hold your hand? And immediately I'm going to go back to playful engagement. Well, sure you can, darling. I would love to hold your hand. That was good use in your words. So I want her to know that she's done a great job of navigating her needs and my needs. And I want her to know it's not about me being angry with her because she talked ugly. But it's about we have to work this out in a way that works for both of us.
That goes back to the philosophy of we're going to work on this together. And I like your approach to compromise. You know, when a child is showing signs of defiance, ask them if they want to compromise. Give them it's giving them a face-saving way out, and it's a potentially averting a showdown. And it's important for parents not to be afraid to compromise, but you have to make sure that they honor their part of the compromise.
That's right. And so we would set it up like that. So I'll give you an example. This child that I worked with in a residential treatment facility who was so violent had been carried to the psychiatric hospital and to the police. I'd taken her to juvenile hall just repeatedly. In the last year, she deteriorated even in the residential treatment. And she was there at bedtime, and she wanted to shampoo her hair every night. Well, she was adopted from Bulgaria at 12 and had been in facilities for 3 years, and now she's 16. And so she's saying to this staff director, I want to shampoo my hair. And I see her body stiffening up. I see her pupils dilating. And he's saying, I've told you, you cannot shampoo your hair. You only have 15 minutes. Everybody in this cottage has to have a bath. You only have 15 minutes to get in and out. And I see this thing building. And I lean over to her and do what we call Jiminy Cricket. So I lean in on to her shoulder and I whisper in her ear, ask if you can have a compromise. And she says to him, can I have a compromise? And then she looks at me and she said, what's a compromise? And so I said, sweetie, a compromise is where he gets part of what he needs and you get part of what you need and everybody's happy. And so she said, can I have a compromise? And he said, well, what did you have in mind? And I whispered, Jiminy Cricket, I'm on her shoulder and I'm playing Jiminy Cricket. Say, can I get in and out of the shower in 15 minutes? If I can do that, can I shampoo my hair every night? And so she asked him, and of course I'm looking at the staff man with these eyes going, you're going to compromise.
You're going to say yes to this.
That's right. You had better say yes. You flew me from Texas to Illinois. You had better say yes to work with this child. And so he said, okay, sure, you can have a compromise. You can every night. Here's the rule, though. My part of the deal is I give you permission to shampoo every night. Your part of the deal is you have to be in and out in your 15 minutes. Is that fair enough? And she says, fair enough. Now, here's the deal. Number one, this little girl has learned to use violent words instead of violence to get her need met, which was a huge win for her. But second, he just went to the bank with about $3 million in a trust account. So what do you think a little girl who goes to the orphanage the day she's born and comes home at 12 years of age, what do you think she's got to comfort herself? Nobody rocks this little girl. Nobody holds this little girl. Nobody gives her a soft satin pillow or blankie to touch. She strokes her little hair. That's all this little girl had. Now she's learned, I hear that you need your hair to be soft and pretty and smell good and touch soft. And you hear that I'm going to meet your need when I can. There's going to be sometimes I have to say no, but when I can, I'm going to say yes. It's a win-win. Everybody, deeper than just getting through that nonviolently, More importantly, that man has connected to her in ways that say, I hear what you need. And I'm empowering you.
It is empowering. And that's something else that came through in the book is, although parents ultimately have to be in charge, children need us to be in charge.
That's right.
It's important to use the least amount of firmness and also the least amount of words as possible in the given situation. We don't always have to escalate. We don't always have to come down with an iron fist when a gentle touch will get us the same place that we're trying to, the place that we want to go, how little can we do and how little interference can we give to get there, knowing all along we have to get there.
Exactly. And, you know, a good analogy for this, I used to love to ride horses when my body wasn't an antique. You know, when you pull the reins for a horse to stop with a certain level of force, the horse stops. If you pull too hard, he starts backing up. And a lot of our parents are using more force than they realize, and then the child, then they're getting into more difficulties with the child. So I'm glad you brought that point up. It's a powerful point.
I think we have time for one last question, and this is going to be from Marianne. My daughter was 5 when we adopted her 4 years ago. In many ways, she seems very attached to us, but it bothers me how she tries to manipulate my husband and me. She tries to divide us. She also uses this technique by trying to pit us against her teachers. She tries to get her teachers' sympathy and get them to interfere with our discipline. What do you suggest we do?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and one I'm sure you know that so many families face.
Mm-hmm.
Children who lived by their wits before they came home to a mother and a daddy who were fierce protectors for them. So a lot of our kids lived by their wits. They're going to use strategies like triangulation that this mother has described, where I try to triangulate these 2 points against that point or this point against that point. And I try to set things where I get what I want in ways that are not appropriate. They also use manipulation and control, and then some children will use aggression. So for the parent whose child comes home saying, my teacher was really mean to me to class today, and she said X, Y, and Z, the parent takes that child by the hand or touches her on the shoulder and says, sweetheart, you know, that's not okay for your parent. I'm going with you to school in the morning. Oh, no, no, you don't need to do that. It's okay now. You know, so for the parent to go to the teacher and say, look, we adore our daughter, but she's got some survival skills that we're trying to help her learn new skills. So one of the things that she's doing is trying to triangulate us against each other. And I need to ask you, whenever she says to you, this is very something about us, that you say, wow, that's very serious. Let me call your mother in the morning and we'll talk about this. Or we'll make an appointment tomorrow afternoon. And once the child realizes that there's open communication between parent and teacher, she can't triangulate those points. Now, there's 2 things going on here, Dawn, and I want to make sure that I speak to both of them. The first is stopping the maladaptive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But the second and more important is giving strategies to the child that works.
Mm-hmm.
My oldest son has a no-yes-yes rule. So he goes to his toddler who's going towards the electric socket with a pencil and says, no electric socket, yes Legos, yes building blocks. So we don't do this, but we do this and we do this.
Mm-hmm.
So to say to the child, it's not okay for you to try to make the teacher angry with us or us angry with the teacher. But look, here are some ways you can get your needs met. So to take away a maladaptive strategy, we have to be giving in its place healthy, life-giving, healing strategies. So always remember, it's a no-yes-yes rule.
That's excellent advice. We are out of time. I am so sorry to say we have questions still coming in, but we will, if possible, we will do this again sometime because
wonderful.
I think that we have a lot of information to share. Thank you, Dr. Karen Purvis, for being my guest today. Her book, The Connected Child, is available, well, it's available everywhere, actually. It's also including on my website, where you can read my review as well as buy the book or buy the book through Amazon. You can also access some of her resources and some articles at the website, and her website is www, of course, child.tcu, that's Texas Christian University, tcu.edu. child.tcu.edu. I will go over that website and try to pull some of the articles and incorporate them under the resources at my site as well. You've been listening to Creating a Family, Talk About Adoption and Infertility. The show is live every Wednesday from 12 to 1 Eastern Time. You can replay this show or download it as a podcast from iTunes, and you can get both the replay and the podcast from creatingafamily.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast from iTunes at that page. To find out about other shows, sign up for the updates from creatingafamily.com. Your email address will never be shared with anyone. The next two shows are infertility related. The next show next week is September 10th, and I will interview Dr. Kathy Rothman about male infertility. And on September 17th, I will talk with Dr. David Hoffman about the facts and myths of IVF. The September 24th show will be on how to deal with a reluctant spouse or unsupported family. This show can apply to either adoption or infertility. And please join me for any and all of these shows. The UN estimates that there are 143 million orphans in the world, including 129,000 currently available for adoption in the U.S. foster system. These kids, as well as the millions of older kids throughout the world, deserve a home. To get more information about the U.S. kids waiting for a family, go to the resources page of creatingafamily.com, where I include a link to the various photo listings of some of these kids. Remember, God smiles when a kid finds a family, and a family finds a child. Thanks for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Oh, the moon. Yeah. That's Hugo tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-oh! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.